From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and it's a pleasure to have all of you with me. I'd like to congratulate Brian on having gotten himself a new dog. He's therefore not with us tonight. The new dog's name is Bethel, and it's a female German Shepherd, so Brian should be home next Friday, and we expect him to be raring to go with his new companion next Tuesday. As usual, I'd like to thank Steve Bauer for his stellar work, not only in recording tonight's program, but then afterwards editing it and turning it into the kind of appropriate program that it ought to be for ACB Radio Mainstream. Obviously, I'd also like to thank George Ives of Talking Communities, whose software makes our programs possible. Tonight we're trying an experiment. We're trying the idea of an open forum. We are actually recording on 9/11, which is of course a pretty significant day, and we'll see if it comes up as one of the topics that anybody wants to discuss. But there are a few folks with us, and hopefully some others will wander in. And I have no idea what we'll actually be discussing. So I'm going to open things up and see who'd like to throw the first topic out for us to bat around. I'd like to remind everyone to please give your name and say where you're from so folks in the listening world will know who you are and where you're from. And now let the open forum begin. Well, let me ask the first question then. One of the things that I thought about this morning is whether 9/11 has had any special impacts on people who are blind or on organizations of the blind. And let me ask you guys what you think about that. Did 9/11 impact us in any special ways that it might not have other groups?
I am Chris Westbrook. I'm from Pennsylvania. In fact, but it's society. I don't know that it's impacting more than society. I mean, you could maybe make a case that we're scrutinized more for security and, you know, our assistive technologies and things like that when we go to airports, but that's true of everyone also. So I'm really not sure that 9/11 has affected us any more than any other group in society.
Thanks, Chris, for your comments. I guess there are three things that have occurred to me with regard to the impact of 9/11 on blind folks and their organizations. One of them is that I think the country has focused far more on things like security and war and various other things, and therefore has less attention that it might be prepared to pay to disadvantaged folks within the society. And so I think one of the impacts has been to make it harder for us to involve society in our issues. I think a second way that 9/11 may have had an impact is in making it more difficult for organizations like ours to actually raise funds, because again, there are just so many other demands for people's money that I think it's harder for us to raise money as a result of 9/11. And I guess the third thing, and the last thing that I'll throw out there for the moment, that I think has been an impact of 9/11 is I think that it contributed to almost an isolation of people with disabilities. I said earlier that I thought that 9/11 had made society less interested in folks with disabilities, but I think it's actually gone further than that. I think there's actually a sense that, you know, we're getting blown up by terrorists and you guys are whining about your rights, you know, kind of go away. I just don't think there's nearly so much patience with or concern for the needs of people with disabilities in the post 9/11 United States. I think our country has become a less kind place to live in, but that's just one man's opinion. Let's see what other people might think.
This is Brian. You didn't think I'd make it in this evening. I certainly do think that any time a nation is involved in some kind of perceived major military involvement in some fashion, it becomes unfashionable to care about much else than that that deals with that issue. So as long as we're a nation at war, albeit in rather bizarre kinds of ways, the fact is that it's fashionable to be patriotic in a way that takes away people's interest from more traditional activities. The same thing took place during the great hurricane that went through and wiped out New Orleans, for example. Virtually every charity in the country that wasn't Katrina-related experienced a major drop in donations for those causes, even if those causes were still viable, like fight cancer, those kinds of things. Certainly, our government has a hard time grappling with any issue that doesn't deal with issues of post 9/11 terrorism-related kinds of concerns. It overwhelms the calendar there pretty thoroughly. I also think that one other thing has impacted us quite a bit, and that is ease of travel. You said I'm down here at the CNI getting a new guide dog, and Bethel's doing well, thank you. And going through security has become more of an issue. And I think more so for a blind person, or a person who's out of the norm, if you will, than others. Having to go through the puffer machine to detect whether or not I'm carrying any residue of an explosive has an impact on me as a guide dog user, in as much as my guide dog can literally be untrained by exposure to those kinds of technologies, frightening them to the point that they're difficult, if at all possible, of going through that kind of a security station. Just one example.
Thank you, Brian. We're glad to have you with us. Other thoughts on the impact of 9/11?
I think in the beginning, by the way, this is Mary from California. I think in the beginning, right after 9/11 happened, I think there was kind of this sort of glitzy sort of gee whiz sort of thing that went on where this blind individual was guided out of the building by his dog, and that was made a big issue of nationally for a while. And I wonder if, as a consequence of that, people start to think, well, blind people ought to be able to deal with life, and because this guy got out of the towers and everything was cool with him, and now we've got this big cleanup to do in New York, and we got to be dealing with that, and we have to worry about national security, and that was kind of how things started to, as you said, Paul, become a less kind place to live and a more challenging place for us.
I think that's interesting. We as blind people tended to idolize this guy too. We certainly regarded him as having gone through an awful lot, and he kind of did the rounds of conferences talking about his experiences, and I think all of us were affected, and for the most part, by his story and by how well his dog did. So it's interesting, but I think you may well be correct. I think that people did begin to see that here was this blind guy who got out. Though for them, I think there was more emphasis on the other person who was with him than there was on his dog.
And there was definitely more emphasis, I think, on the dog than there was on the guy. I mean, the dog helped him out, but the guy had to know what he was doing in order to get out. And that's one thing that the public doesn't understand about, guide dogs. And that could be a whole other show of how the public deals with guide dogs and all that kind of stuff. I'm on the post.
Yep, Chris, I think you're absolutely correct. I guess it's time for me to ask what the next subject will be on our kind of forum. What is another element that's on your mind, or another thing that you think we might perhaps spend a little time talking about?
Well, one thing that I just thought of, and hopefully this won't get too controversial, but I've had some mobility instructors over the years who have given me some really, really, frankly, bad advice, and who haven't in my opinion, probably shouldn't have been mobility instructors, and one who clearly didn't want to do it. And the only reason she was given to me was because I was supposedly deafblind and she knew sign language. But anyway, I was just curious how whether other people, like for example, I have one mobility instructor who told me whenever I got lost, instead of, you know, trying to find my way back and you know, trying to explore and possibly find a way back or something, to just stand there and wait and ask for help as soon as I knew I was lost. And I'm just wondering how competent are mobility as a whole, and how does, if they are not all that competent, how does that affect, you know, I was lucky in that I had the confidence to tell, to sort out sort of the good advice from the bad advice, and I took what I could from the instructors that I had, but I know that's not true of a lot of people, and I wonder how that helps or hinders us as a community when we get bad advice like that.
Oh boy, you pushed my button. I'm totally deaf on my right side, so I cannot tell where sound is coming from at all, and I don't cross these big, huge 8-lane streets that I happen to live on and where the nearest cross street is. And I had one instructor one time tell me that she was going to teach me how to cross these big streets. Apparently she came out and she looked at the streets, but she didn't try crossing them with her eyes closed or her one ear blocked, and she was just going to take me across these streets. And I said, no ma'am, I don't want to get killed. I think some of the things that they tell you just kind of go beyond anything that even qualifies as common sense. And I think as far as safety is concerned, we have to use our common sense to just do what we think is the best for us, because we're the ones that are living the adventure, so to speak. But yeah, you're not the only one who's hearing impaired out there.
Thanks, Mary and Chris. This is an intriguing topic. I guess I think there are kinds of two sorts of orientation and mobility instructor out there these days. One kind is the kind that you guys are talking about, and these are the traditionalists who tend to think that you can actually teach mobility in a sort of one-size-fits-all manner. And then there are the new, if you like, NFB-type O&M instructors who really believe that an awful lot has to be left up to the individual who is being taught, and who often use some kind of interesting techniques in order to help the person, quote, learn a lesson. So it's an interesting issue. Anyone else have some other thoughts on the current state of O&M instructors?
Brian here, and I have two or three things I'll toss into the melee. One is, I have to tell you that I've always been astounded that individuals believe one has to have a master's degree to teach orientation and mobility. One, we have a real shortage in terms of the availability of O&M instructors, especially outside of the major metropolitan areas. And two, the master's degree track for O&M instructors appears to have a great deal more to do with getting that second degree in such a way that it will give you a leg up into management in the field of blindness and low vision. I was lucky enough today to be one of three panelists here at the CNI as programs that teach individuals to be orientation and mobility instructors. We're here visiting from, Missouri State and Florida State University programs. And we were, of course, interested in trying to convince them that in addition to the long white cane, the dog guide was a viable means of orientation and mobility, and that, in fact, it's not a, you know, if all else fails, you can get a dog, or the other way around, that you have to be a wunderkind in order to be able to use a guide dog effectively. Or as Ken Jernigan once told me, one imposes a dog on others. We were there to try to explain to them our personal experiences, why we chose it to use a guide dog as opposed to a cane. And I think that the questions they asked were pretty good ones. a couple of things that seem to be happening in orientation and mobility. One is a great number of those getting their degrees in orientation and mobility are already teachers of the visually impaired or already a rehabilitation teacher, and they're adding this to their list of skills to make themselves more marketable. I'm not sure that's going to mean for a better product for the consumer, though I expect that it will mean more ready access to O&M instruction. And I also think that at least if they're coming out of the college and university programs today, they're likely to carry with them a couple of things that I'm looking forward to them having skills in, and that's the use of technology and orientation mobility, specifically GPS systems, and also a more open attitude about different ways to achieve that independence and mobility. I personally haven't had the problem of having somebody be so staid in how they do things that they were going to do it one way and one way only. I've had some fairly creative orientation mobility instructors over the years. But I do think that there is this growing tendency toward the one more arrow in my quiver as I go out to seek employment. So I can be an occupational therapist, a rehabilitation teacher, and an O&M instructor, and that's going to make me so important at my agency that they don't dare let me off, or lay me off, rather. That kind of an attitude.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I don't know that that's a good thing either. I mean, I think that people who teach certain skills, at least I think for the most part, mobility instructors should be specialized in that field and not necessarily other things, but and I feel that everyone ought to have specialties in the field that they're teaching in, at least that's my opinion.
I think the idea of technology brings up a really interesting issue. I'm a cane user and have been just forever, and back a long time ago when they were still making the MOAT sensor, which is kind of similar to the Sonic Guide in what it does, I had an instructor who was able to teach me how to use the MOAT sensor quite effectively, and apparently she had to go through some training to learn how to use it. So I wonder if some of the more modern technology that's coming out would require some additional training on the part of mobility teachers so that they might be able to better instruct their clients in how to use this stuff. Although I suppose a lot of the technology, you're supposed to be able to just take it out of the box and use it, right? Isn't that the way a lot of this stuff works now?
If only that were so. I don't think there's a single O&M product out there right now. I'm talking about GPS-based, whether it's for your Braille node or your PacMate or the standalone tracker, that can be effectively used just by taking it out of the box, getting past the whole installation and the like, knowing how to pair it effectively with your cane skills or pair it effectively with your guide dog using skills that would allow you to use it to augment how you already get around rather than to supplant how you already get around. There's an awful lot of people who participate in these trekking expeditions. I think Sendero Group is partial sponsor of them, who once they start listening to their GPS device kind of allow all of the training that they've received in the use of a guide dog or a cane to go out the window while they're busy listening to it, kind of like those who walk around while using a cell phone, for example. So I think that there is a value in getting professional training in the use of them in cooperation with or as part of orientation and mobility instruction. I certainly wouldn't want to try it any other way. And I have tried it the other ways as a matter of necessity, but it certainly wouldn't be my first choice.
Well, I think it's encouraging that that mobility instructors may want to use the technology. I think that that will help us see a lot more that way, and that is encouraging that they're using it that way. And I do believe that the Leader Dog School in Rochester, Michigan, is working on using these GPS, and maybe other schools are as well, or guide dog schools, and maybe it would be encouraging if the rehab centers use them. I don't know for sure if they are. It would be nice if they are.
I guess I'd make
two or three points, partly in response to points that Brian made and partly in response to those that were made by Gary. And the first one is to say to Gary that, I think it's very cool that dog guide schools are in fact the places that are appearing to do more to embrace GPS technology than most other places are. I think one of the issues that we truly need to look at hard is why it is that pre-service training for orientation and mobility instructors and for other professionals in the field of blindness doesn't appear to have changed nearly so much as it probably should have. Where is the textbook on how an O&M instructor should teach GPS? Where is the textbook on how to integrate GPS training into regular mobility? And where is that regular training of GPS technology in the curriculum of most rehabilitation centers? It is amazing to me the degree to which it now appears as though we are stuck in the war of orientation mobility instructors in terms of who should teach, but we don't appear to be engaging in serious debate over the kind of training that ought to happen and the number of modern changes that ought to be incorporated into O&M curriculum around the country.
Well, it would seem to me that there shouldn't be this war, and it seems like these mobility instructors should have been in the forefront of teaching this technology. I mean, they should have been ahead of the curve as far as learning about it and then teaching about it instead of behind the curve, if that's where they are.
One of the interesting things about orientation mobility instructors is they tend to be the folks who have been in university the longest, and they have tended over the past 20 or 30 years, I think, to get promoted to administrative positions more quickly than people who aren't O&M instructors. And so one of the issues that we face in a field that already is hugely short of personnel is that probably the field that loses the largest number of participants to promotion is the field of O&M and M instructors.
I mean, yes, an O&M instructor needs training to teach O&M properly, especially to someone who is nearly blinded. But I'm not sure that a master's degree is really necessary. I mean, some of the best orientation that I've received, now granted, this is after I've had my initial training, but some of the best orientation and mobility that I've received are from people who haven't been trained at all in mobility. They just have a common sense way of you know, they understand the landmarks we need and the way to show us how to get places. Do you really need a master's degree to be an O&M? I can see a bachelor's, but a master's degree?
Yeah, I've had friends that have taught me far better than any mobility instructor. In fact, I had one elderly friend of mine who taught me how to get somewhere that a bunch of us were meeting. In fact, it was a building in which my church was meeting, and it was about 2.5 blocks from me, and I had no idea how to get there. And she drove 10 miles down to see me just to walk me to this place, and we got to a point where I said, well, how am I going to tell when to turn? And she says, well, just explore and see if you can figure it out. And I did, and after just an hour of simple just walking around, she taught me more than probably anybody else that I've ever known did. And she was, 65, 70 years old and just a really good friend of mine. So some people can just think sighted and some people can think blind, and it really is a gift that some people have.
Well, I think it's a good point, and maybe that's true. But on the other hand, just think of maybe as good as the training that you received is, maybe it would have been a lot better if they had had the master's degree or the more education in how to do it. Like, a lot of the people at university to learn this have to wear sleep shades. They have to get used to the idea of being blind, and they have to adjust to that fact before they can take those off. And they have to get used to what how a blind person thinks, how a blind person feels, and what he thinks and what he feels, and the whole quandary of things.
I'm with you, Chris. This is Brian. I'm not convinced it requires a master's degree, but I do believe it requires professional training to be good at something. We all know people who are really great teachers, even though they didn't go to get a degree in teaching. And we know people who are, you know, really good at some other skills without having had professional training in them. It doesn't negate the need for training, and I'm not suggesting that O&M instruction to learn to be an all-round good at orientation mobility can't be something that is taught. But I do doubt that it requires a master's degree. I think that as with many skills for professionals in the field of blindness in particular, there's a growing number of things we're asking them to master. I'm convinced that to be a teacher of the visually impaired in a public school setting today is much more difficult than it was in the day that I needed such instruction. And I think orientation and mobility is the same way. Traffic patterns are more complicated than ever before. It's not like the days when you could simply go to an intersection and wait for a specific amount of time and hear the signal snap over and you could hear that noise and use that as your cue for crossing. There's just too many ways to skin a cat out there these days for somebody to go out and kind of wing it when it comes to these kinds of things, as our friends and family do. And you know, I'm not saying don't use that as well, but I don't confuse that with the skill level I expect from an orientation and mobility instructor. I do find it amazing sometimes how many O&M instructors are incapable of telling their left hand from their right, or incapable of giving directions orally in a way that I can personally follow. But I think that's not a matter, again, of training. I think that's a matter of inclination or innate ability. Like being able to read a map versus not being able to read a map. It falls in that same category. I appreciate orientation and mobility instructors. I appreciate we don't have enough of them. I appreciate they need more training in certain areas like GPS and perhaps alternative techniques for exploring an unknown environment by a client so that they can become independently mobile in those areas without requiring the direct services of an O&M instructor. I would say, though, that in this whole mix, the biggest need they all have to have is a flexibility to deal with all of the issues that face us, much more complex than in the old days.
One of the models that's been proposed is one we actually got involved in at Miami-Dade College and that I supervised for a number of years. And that was a certificate program in orientation mobility where we required folks to take some English and some sociology and lots of orientation and mobility at their local lighthouse, but then offered those folks a certificate which enabled them to earn some more money and which also demonstrated a certain proficiency in terms of orientation and mobility. And the biggest argument that I operated with in trying to sell the program was this. The fact is, if you've got a master's degree, and many orientation mobility instructors do, you've acquired a huge number of skills that you can pass on to others. An awful lot of orientation and mobility, particularly at the beginning, is very much rote from day to day. Let's walk up and down in front of the building while you get your cane technique down. Let's work day to day to be sure that we can cut down as far as we're able to on your veering by having you walk around several blocks. If there were folks who had, say, certificates in orientation and mobility, or folks who had bachelor's degrees in orientation and mobility, those folks can concentrate on doing those routine day-to-day things and leave the really difficult clients who are having serious problems for the master's degree folks who presumably have the training and the experience to actually deal well with complicated issues. Okay, Any final thoughts on O&M before we throw it open for a third and what will probably be our final subject for the evening?
I just wanted to chirp in and say, I think that you have a point, Paul, with respect to the level of experience and training needing to be appropriate for the specific need. In the same way that a child can benefit from the services of a paraprofessional, a more affordable, though less trained individual, on a day-to-day basis, under the supervision and with the assistance of and direction from a qualified, trained teacher of the visually impaired, I think the same kind of model could work for orientation and mobility.
Good evening, Sanisio. And it's a subject dear to my heart. I'm a firm believer in the use of assistants and paraprofessionals. I started a paraprofessional training program back in New York in the early 80s, and I thought it was very successful. But it's still to this day, it's professionals in the field are, because it's, I guess, a relatively new profession, both in O&M and as well as in RT, that there's a great deal of fear and trepidation about those paraprofessionals ultimately being regarded as professionals or taking over. And in some cases, I guess, that may have happened. But if I could just go back, because I was trying to key in before and I couldn't, but I think one of the challenges I see with O&M instructors or the field of O&M recently is probably one that mirrors what I see the field of visual rehab kind of moving into, in which the idea of that we are getting away from what we know works. In mobility, we are less and less effective in encouraging, I think, clients to take risks, to go beyond, you know, what they think their capabilities are, to push the envelope. And we are, I think, way too often helping them or enabling them to settle for paratransit, for example, or for not taking those risks, for not taking public transportation, etc. And that's the thing that really is discouraging to me.
This is going to be kind of an unusual take on things. When I attended conventions, this is long ago, in the Federation, for 3 years, they paired people with really good mobility individuals who had just simply life experience. And, you know, I put a blindfold on and went out with the guy for 8 hours. We, you know, stuck together like a duo, you know, walking around. And it was scary, as you can imagine. But we were given homework assignments, and it really helped. And insofar as I was not going to get realistic O&M training at all, this was better than nothing. So when we all returned, we actually did volunteer O&M training with very selected people doing it, picking the students, and we helped people who were moving to a new neighborhood. We did it in nursing homes, that sort of thing. The nursing home thing was harder because the people were older, but I noticed that the person who was assigned to me, who was very, very supportive, learned O&M when his parents gave him a cane. He was 7, and he figured out the driveway. And I think that there's a role for very careful volunteerism. And, you know, I certainly appreciated a chance to get a skill that I was not going to get otherwise.
I think these are certainly valid points. And we've skirted an issue that we might as well actually put on the table. One of the issues that's out there at the moment is whether or not severely visually impaired individuals and or totally blind folk ought to be O&M instructors. And it's a pretty major debate that's going on at the moment. I would gather from your message that you certainly think there's a role for individuals and or who are substantially visually impaired in providing training in orientation and mobility.
Well, I don't think any person can necessarily teach any skill. In this 3-year experiment, I was in the first group. The pairing was done very, very well. And when we were several years did this on a volunteer basis, there was a huge amount of discussion as to who would do it, under what circumstances. And it was very, very gradually done. I actually did it for someone orienting somebody to a neighborhood. I did it twice, but I will assure you that it was like just totally incrementally done. And, you know, because I didn't want to get myself killed or the other person killed. In fact, the first time I did it, I had a sighted person watching us just to make sure, you know, from the standpoint of liability. And, you know, I didn't do a half bad. You know, I worked very hard to help the individual. And there just simply is not enough O&M training available. In my area, orientation mobility is not considered a standard rehabilitation fare. You know, if you want O&M training, you've got to go out and buy your own training at $70 a pop. I feel sorry for newly blinded people. I don't want to identify the state, but it just, it, you know, in my city, O&M is not considered what you get. So what are the, where are these people going to pick this up? Unless, you know, I'm not saying any, you know, any C-minus skilled blind person has the ability to do it, but you know, it's a responsibility, and people have to really think out what they're going to teach and where they're going to teach it and that sort of thing.
Sue Ellen, one of our participants who doesn't have an active mic tonight, indicates that she agrees with what many people have said in a text message, and indicates that she had an instructor who was there for a while and then suddenly left, and now she's been waiting for 2 months for any instruction, and she recognizes that the shortage is really there, and that we truly need to find a way of making a broader range of orientation mobility instruction available. Last chance at O&M.
I do think very carefully selected blind people could do it. I think the fact that I learned from someone who was totally blind gave me a lot of encouragement, because I've been in two emergency situations where there was no light. And just realizing that, you know, the guy who taught me couldn't see at all, you know, absolutely convinced me that I was going to get out. If people want to volunteer to teach it in the, you know, correctly picked situation, I think it should be encouraged, because I see only future cuts in training ahead of us, and it's, you know, not a pretty picture.
Okay. I think we have time for one other forum topic. Would anybody like to throw something out?
Well, last week we were discussing, I don't know if it was on the program or afterwards, that cuts have been made, and we talked some on the show about the 70% unemployment rate, and I mentioned something about that cuts have been made in the past 30 years about, maybe 25 would be more accurate, but, you know, the government has cut back on funding of a lot of things, and maybe the qualified individuals that were doing a lot of the training of blind individuals is not there as it was back in the 70s, possibly, and because the funds aren't there for the training that they need. And it's possible that maybe that contributed to a lot of the unemployment rate, that some of the blind people weren't adequately trained to get jobs and to learn the skills that it takes to be in the world work.
I think your point about the cuts that are out there is interesting, but I guess I'm not quite sure I know where you're really going with it. I don't know of a lot of evidence that's out there that says that the government is actually spending any less on rehabilitation now than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. So I don't know that there have been any cuts in funding. The number of private agencies that serve blind people has grown over the last 10 to 20 years across the country. So I would certainly suggest that rather than contracting, services for people who are blind have actually expanded, especially if you include independent living centers that have become more focused on blindness and so on. Anishio Korea, one of our participants, has just left a text message that says that even though what I say may be true, there certainly has not been a requisite increase in the amount of service that's delivered that accounts for what's actually out there in terms of need for services based on demand and based on people getting older and starting to lose vision. Do you think that in the past 10 years, services have been cut?
Well, here, absolutely. The supervisor of the rehab counselors has a right to veto and is cutting people's options to O&M, for example, to mine computers. definitely services here have been cut to the point where people cannot get more than 1 year in college. It's pretty drastic because blind people are not just competing against blind people. Blind people are competing against the rehab needs of people with other disabilities.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there. I think, and again, I don't have numbers to substantiate what I'm saying here. I think the demand for service has increased. The nature, the population we're working with is one that requires often more one-on-one attention, and the funding has not increased commensurate with those needs. So I think, in real terms, that probably I would think that there have been funding cuts. I think what you said too, and I forgot your name, but the person who just went before me, I think it's so true. The things that we used 2 years ago take for granted, whether it's mobility or rehab instruction or access to a computer, or now I think we often have to justify and constantly advocate and fight for it, and especially in states where blindness services are mixed with general rehab services, and you have people making decisions that have very little, on the state level, very little knowledge and background about blindness.
Well, I think that there's a number of things I'd like to agree with and a number of things I'd like to disagree with. One is, I do agree that in a generic one-size-fits-all rehabilitation system where there's no specialty knowledge on the part of the decision-makers about issues associated with blindness, that blind people tend to get fewer services than they would if they were served by a blindness agency with individuals with that expertise. I'm not sure that I would agree that it has meant that things are harder to come by. I do think, well, let me back up. Yes, things are harder to come by, but I don't necessarily think it's all a financial issue. I think there's some value in getting away from the entitlement approach toward these things and have to justify them. I worry that people who graduate from high school automatically assume that the state agency is going to pay for them to go to college, even if they haven't done what's necessary for them to be successful in a college environment. I don't think it's appropriate to assume that individuals should get financial support because they're unemployed if they're not somehow or other engaged in a process that will lead to employment if the opportunity arises. So I think that there's some value in the struggle of not having something be a given, that something's going to take place for you, that you're going to get a service. I hate the idea that only those individuals who are informed enough to know what to ask for get those services. I would like to think that professionals in the field explain to an individual what services may be available to them if they do the prerequisite skill building, et cetera, that the agency responsible for husbanding those funds has determined are necessary for a high rate of success in their use, whether that be a college education, a computer, training and orientation and mobility, whatever it might be. I have no doubt that dollars are tighter now than ever before, that's a combination of the priorities that our governments set, many of which I disagree with. I really hate to see disability organizations fight over the same scraps rather than to argue the value of their type of services with limited dollars rather than other types of activities with those same dollars. I think we can make the argument well, but I think we're too often set at one another's throats. And certainly the biggest effect on all of the shortfalls of funding is a growing number of individuals who could and need to use the service, whose needs are coming later in life and therefore don't quite fit the standard process that we've used over the years.
And I feel pretty much the same way. And maybe some of the disabled people groups might be pitted against one another, but also maybe we might be fighting those who are looking for employment, may be fighting for the same crumbs as the senior blind, who can argue that they probably need more important help because of losing their, more people are going blind later in life, as it's know, quite possible that that's the case. I mean, I think that there's merit in the idea that, that we need to struggle, or sometimes maybe we need, maybe we should get rid of the entitlement mentality. But the thing is, if we're going to do that, if people should pay for the things that they should buy, maybe they need some courses in home management to show them how to budget money so that they can buy the things they need instead of having things given to them. I suppose it would be, maybe some of them need the training to know how to plan for the time that they might need a computer or need some of the things that they'll need, or GPS or anything like that.
Just to respond to or kind of follow up on what Brian said, this is Anisha from Atlanta. One of the things that I've noticed in the last 30 years I've been doing this is that nowadays it's harder to get counselors in some states, not all I'm sure, but in some states, to understand the need for basic rehabilitation instruction, O&M, ADL skills training, communications, Braille, computer training, aside from whether or not what that person's goal is in employment or whatever, just to be independent in their home. That's extremely difficult to justify and to get it paid for. And often, you know, when you have a newly blinded adult, they have no idea about what they're going to do, how they can do it, and even or believe that they can do anything of vocational nature. So it is very hard to justify to a counselor the intrinsic value of those pre-vocational services. That's a big difference I see nowadays.
I agree with you that a holistic approach toward rehabilitation is something that rehab counselors, generally speaking, are not pressed to do. Before you get employment, you need to be capable of living alone. You need to be capable of getting from home to work and back again safely. You need to be able to manage the monies that you earn in an effective manner. You need to know how to use technology in general before you learn to use technology for a very specific job. It both gives you a good grounding, but at least as importantly, it means that you're not subject to, if a particular industry lays you off, that you are not capable of any other kind of employment because you only knew how to use a computer to do X, and you don't know how to use a computer in general. Those kind of things, absolutely, I think, are true out there and are a harder struggle now than ever before. Everybody's looking for the quick fix. So statistically, we've seen a number of studies over the years that indicate that the most likely person to be employed is a person who, when they lose their vision, become legally blind, an effort is made to keep them at work. But this also means that they haven't been allowed time to come to grips with their blindness and dealing with the non-vocational skills that allow them to have an opinion of themselves that allow them to go to work each day and go home and be the father and the mother and the, you know, whatever other roles you might have outside the workplace that definitely impact on your competence levels that allow you to be a person in the workplace.
The National Federation of the Blind has probably done a better job than most places of incorporating some philosophy of blindness into what they offer at their centers. But I feel fairly strongly that, unfortunately, that's a flawed purpose. And often blind folks are being, if you like, propagandized rather than necessarily truly learning to become stronger and more capable blind folks. Sue Ellen, one of our participants without a mic, has raised an interesting question, which I will throw out for people to consider. Sue Ellen says that part of the problem is that right now we appear to be asking blind people not to contribute to their own rehabilitation. She says that she wishes there were a way of actually offering blind people a loan or something, which they would use to pay for part of the cost of their rehabilitation, and that eventually, presumably through going to work or some other way, people who are blind would be able to raise sufficient funds to repay the loan. But there would be, I think the implication is, much more willingness to really try to learn the stuff once and for all if, in fact, you were paying part of the cost.
Well, I think that we kind of do this already, although it's not called what it is, and that statistically individuals who achieve employment as a result of rehabilitation just think that we pay back in taxes once we become taxpayers more than the cost of the service that we were rendered that enabled us to go out and seek successfully employment. I think the statistics support that. I think, though, that there is value in one aspect of what you said, and that is there should be some sweat equity. One should not expect to get something for nothing, but that way that one pays for that service that you get can be in terms of volunteering to society in general. A lot of people put in some serious hours in volunteering to improve the lives of others in one form or another. That's one way you can pay back. And I think the idea that when you go to a rehabilitation program or get the service, we were talking earlier about getting a homework assignment and doing that homework assignment. Again, if an individual agrees to accept a given service and then is kind of kicked back and relaxed about it and doesn't treat it seriously enough to do the investment of time and energy it requires to truly master a given skill, then they aren't paying for it.
Paul, for your comment on the inculcating of the propagandizing of the attitudes at some of the programs, I've known people who have been through them. Self-esteem is one thing as long as one is getting the Braille and all the training one's supposed to get. And hours and hours and hours of discussion groups, I'm not sure are that beneficial. Now, as to our attitudes about ourselves, I don't see why we have to justify getting a service by proving that we're paying for it. I mean, we send children to school and teach children to read and math because that's essential in the primary grades. When a person experiences a disability, that person is learning an entire skill set, and to expect someone to pay for the skill set that they don't already have seems to be almost like a self-hating exercise. We are deserving of this simply because we want to be independent. I don't see that we have to keep proving ourselves and justifying ourselves that we are as good as our sighted counterparts because we already are as good as our sighted counterparts. I don't think anybody wants to give anybody a free ride, but here with all the privatization, we'll be lucky if we have recognizable blind services 10 years from now, because things are being consolidated far away from clients. Services that used to be offered are not. People have to pay for their own job, their own college education, and I think we should demand that agencies have people who help place people in jobs.
I actually agree with Brian, and this lady that just spoke, I think that the rehabilitation services is a right for people, and it should be they should be provided. And as Brian said, someone else said, it's proven that Gary that the return on the investment on that money is truly a good investment. And I say that having myself paid for services. I learned mobility when I was in Portugal. I paid for it. I determined when the instruction was going to stop, basically when I ran out of money. And the same way back in, I remember, in 84 when I purchased my first computer. I went to in New York to Baruch College, found one of the instructors, and paid him on an hourly basis. And I dictated the curriculum, dictated the outline, what I wanted to learn. So I think there are times when that certainly should be an option. But I think for independence training, for basic rehabilitation training, I mean, that is absolutely the government responsibility. And that's what we pay taxes for.
Good evening, Paul. Steve Bauer. Well, maybe I'm really going to throw some gasoline on the fire here. But one thing that I have seen over the years, and this actually applies to almost any state or federal government agency, is incompetent employees. It seems that once a person gets hired into a government or a state position, that regardless of their performance, they just cruise on through. And I think we have a lot of incompetent people in our rehabilitation services and agencies that flat don't know what they're doing, that are trying to provide guidance and support and training to people, and they are clueless. And as a result, I think that the people that most desperately need this rehabilitation and the services that are supposed to be provided by that agency are flat losing out.
Mr. Bauer, I think you raise a good issue, and I think it is one that has a good deal of merit. The quality of service and the retention of high-quality services is getting harder and harder to demonstrate any longer. It's another interesting question to ask what we could do about it. And, of course, we could suggest that one option that's out there is really meaningful accreditation procedures for all of our agencies. That wouldn't be provided by CARF. It could potentially have been provided by NAC, but NAC is now actually broadening the number of agencies that it's serving, but is still serving a very small proportion of the actual blindness organizations that are out there. How else could we improve services? It's a very good question, and perhaps a subject that we could devote a whole show to. How can we improve the quality of rehabilitation services to folks who are out there?
I work for an agency which has just undergone reaccreditation last fall, and I'm actually I've participated in many NAC review teams as a reviewer.
I would love it if somebody could host a forum where we can design a rehab system that would meet all the criteria we've been outlining here this evening. Rather than talk about, well, this doesn't work and that doesn't work and the other thing doesn't work, I think we all agree that the system is a bit ill, that we say, all right, let's build an imaginary, at this point, rehabilitation system that would accomplish the things that we've been talking about and see how it differs from what the current system is and how we can morph the current system into what we envision. I think that might make for a very interesting program.
I think there are a number of possibilities for future programs. I really like the last one the best, Brian. I think that would actually be fun. Build your own rehab system. I think we ought to even consider it pretty soon, perhaps even for next week. Ladies and gentlemen who've participated this evening, thank you very much. I think our experiment in trying a general forum has certainly been of interest. I think there are a number of topics that we've covered tonight which have been interesting, and I appreciate everyone's full participation. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for listening on ACB Radio, a place where hearing is believing, and believing leads to action. Thanks for being with us.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.